Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 3rd, 2006. Today's session is entitled Foundation for Building Check and Balance Communities. Moving from Needs to Assets, presented by Jody Kretzman, number KRJO 2006-5. Let's listen in.
Let me say a word of introduction about who I am and what this is about. I'm Jody Kretzman. I come from Chicago. And there I, with my wife Ingrid, have been living and acting in Chicago's civic and political culture for many decades and roaming the neighborhoods of Chicago, doing a lot of work with people and communities in Chicago. I'm at Northwestern University there, where I teach and direct an institute called the Asset-Based Community Development Institute, ABCD. It's as simple as. And the work of that institute has expanded and spread over the last few decades so that we're now working across North America and on five other continents as well, with a set of approaches to how to build strong communities. And so I'm going to do a little bit this week on building strong communities and some of the lessons we think we're learning, some of the directions that community building, community development is taking across the U.S. and beyond, and see if we can be in conversation about how a number of things, including the experience of Holden Village, plays into the ideas that are now afoot about building strong and vital communities. We first started coming to Holden almost 30 years ago, and the first thing I want to say is that an awful lot of how I've been thinking about community development, writing about it over the last decades, has really been strongly influenced by Holden. Holden is a place that is set apart and that tries continuously to build and rebuild communities, and I think it really pays, if you're interested in communities, to pay attention to what Holden tries all the time. As Dwayne and many others in the room know, it doesn't always work, but the efforts are always there, and the strategies are interesting that have been attempted here. Just a bit of personal background. What I want to do today, by the way, is to sort of set an overall framework for the discussion for the weekend, and we'll go in a variety of different directions.
Sorry, so I don't have to look for that.
On Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I first got involved in thinking about local communities, particularly struggling communities, when I was a sophomore in college and got an invitation from an incredibly courageous group of young African-American college students in the South many decades ago who were inviting some Northern college student colleagues to come and join them in a place called Mississippi for a summer of working to register voters and to teach in places called freedom schools. And so I spent just a five-week period in the middle of my college years living and learning in an extended black family in the Mississippi Delta, 53 people, sharecroppers living in about 12 different shacks. At that point, the older folks in that particular extended family could remember their grandparents who had experienced slavery firsthand. Of the 53 people that I stayed with, only one had as much as a sixth grade formal education. But what I have to report is that that brief period in my life taught me more about the most important, seemed to me, issues in my life than all of my previous or subsequent years at Princeton University and at other places that I've studied since. I learned more in those 5 weeks from that extended African-American family in Mississippi about faith and about community and about courage and about strategic thinking and about sort of placing oneself into history rather than having history happen to you than I've ever learned before or since. What it also taught me those 5 weeks in Mississippi was that not all wisdom is resident in universities. Some of it is, and that's important. But an awful lot of it is resident in communities, and that it pays to pay attention to the wisdom that is resident in communities. So that much of my subsequent life has been spent in communities, mostly struggling communities, listening to people who are doing the hard work of making hopeful things happen in tough situations. At one point in my life, a couple decades ago now, a colleague of mine, John McKnight, and I got a healthy foundation grant to spend about 3.5 years traveling the United States, visiting over and over again some of the most devastated communities in the United States. So we spent a lot of time in the 25 largest cities and in Appalachia and in a lot of Native people's reservations. And when we were in the cities, we were in places like the South Bronx in New York City and in Liberty City in Miami, which was just on the news again in the last couple of weeks with the seven guys who somehow were a threat to the Sears Tower in Chicago. Spent a lot of time in Watts in Los Angeles, a lot of time in public housing all over the place. And we would visit these places over and over again, get to know some people there. And sometimes when I recite that itinerary, people look at me like that must have been a terrible way to spend 3 years, visiting all these depressing places over and over again. And I think what my brief report to you is this afternoon is that it was exactly the opposite. It was an odyssey that was filled with hope and with lessons and learnings and in creativity. And the reason, I think, was that we had decided to go into tough places, meet leaders at the grassroots level, and study not what was broken, which was pretty evident, but what was working. Where were the hopeful things happening? Where were people in tough situations taking the parks back from the drug dealers? Where were the schools being turned around, beginning to be turned around? Where were kids taken out of gang situations and given the opportunity to be constructive contributors to community? We ended up collecting about 3,000 of those little stories and started calling them hope stories. And we started sort of sifting through them and being in conversation with people across the United States about what they meant.
How did you collect them? In what way?
We wrote them up. Not all in person. Some we got by phone. Some people would connect us to and say, "Oh, you ought to go." You know, the Rosebud Sioux people were doing some incredibly interesting things. Call them up and see what they're up to. But most of them were sort of in person conversations with people. We would hear a lot of word of mouth stuff. You ought to see what they're doing. You know, with gangs in Chattanooga,
right?
So we go to Chattanooga and see what that was about. At the end of this period, we picked about the top 200, 250 of them, tried to arrange them in a way where some of the lessons came to the fore, and put them in a book called Building Communities from the Inside Out. And we tried to write the book in non-academic language, in language that reflected the experience and ways of thinking of people in the communities. And that played back to people in communities the lessons to be learned. Much to our astonishment, a little over a decade later, we learned that in the community development field, which is not a big pond, but it is a pond anyway, this has become the best-selling book ever in the community development field. And I think there's some reasons for that. It had nothing to do with our genius. It had to do with the way in which people, when asked, can relate their own successes, can relate their own experiences in ways that engage lots and lots of other people. So that's the sort of basis of the work, and then since that book has come out, we've been engaged in producing another 16 or 18 workbooks. One of the ones that is most popular with Holden folks is a book called Asset-Based Strategies for Faith Communities. And it reflects a whole series of sort of fruitful experiments with that people in faith communities are undertaking. There's some people in the Salvation Army that are working in this way. There are lots of people in ELCA congregations, and they're reported on in the book. There are people in seminaries. There are people in a variety of different judicatory positions working on community development in this way. So. Anybody who's interested, as this conversation proceeds during this week, we can talk about some of the materials that are available. So that's the sort of overview. Our focus has always been on local communities. We understand that it's critically important to talk about whole metropolises and regions and states and federal government and even global dynamics. But for us, the sort of key turf has been the local turf. What are people doing in towns and villages, in local neighborhoods, in local parishes? How does that come alive? We also recognize that people, all of us in this room, belong to multiple communities. We have often some kind of a geographic neighborhood that defines who we are, but we're also part of communities of interest or of cultural heritage or of language or a whole variety of different kinds of communities. Again, I want to say that most of our research is limited to a geographic definition of community, but I think I have been learning over the last years that a lot of what we're finding that's effective in local geographically defined communities also spills over into other kinds of communities as well. Let me also here at the outset report a couple of developments over the last decade that have reinforced our idea that focusing on the local is at least a part of what we all critically need to be about. I think one of the developments in research in this area has been the mounting, convincing evidence that without activating local people in local places, you can't get to the production of any of the good outcomes that people wish for. So for example, when I get into conversation with people in communities about what would you like this community to be like? What are your dreams about what this could be? They say things like, well, we want our families to thrive. We want our kids to thrive. We want everybody to be healthy or as healthy as they can be. We want to be in a safe community. We want to be in a community that's economically viable, right? Those kinds of things get said. And what we've discovered, I think with more and more convincing evidence to back it up, is that you can't get there to any of those places without activating the local community. So for example, when a number of years ago we're just a little place at Northwestern, that's ABCD Institute. We're known as people who know about community development stuff. And a number of years ago, we started getting strange phone calls, it seems strange for us, from places like the American Medical Association and the American Hospital Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we were sort of wondering, why are we getting these phone calls? What do they want with us, right? And we would ask them, somebody from the AMA called and said, can we meet with you guys? Would you come down to Atlanta? And we got a day long thing here, can we meet with you guys? And we would say, sure, we try to be good neighbors. And then we would ask, what do you want to meet about? And they were sort of strangely inarticulate. They just said, well, we think there's something we ought to be talking with you about, but we're not quite sure what it is. So after a number of these encounters, we decided we'd talk with some of our friends in the medical field at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago, and so we went over there and presented them with our dilemma. We're getting these phone calls, we don't know why they're calling us, and they don't know why they're calling us. So what can we, I don't know about you, but I like to sort of go into meeting somewhat prepared for whatever it might be. And I wasn't at that point. So we asked our friends to help us understand it. And they led us into a medical library, the epidemiological wing of it, and said, here are about 8,000 volumes on the shelves here, and these volumes contain the answer to your question, right? And then it looked like they were about to leave, right? And sort of leave us with these 8,000 volumes. And we didn't want to stay in a library with 8,000 volumes. We had no desire to lead a second life. And so we just gave up and we were walking out the door. And then they were so kind, they said to us, look, we understand you're not going to read all this stuff. And so they were kind enough to put the content of those 8,000 volumes on one overhead, which I will now share you. And the question was, they said, what you're being asked about by the American Medical Association is to be in a conversation with them about how health gets created. Where does health come from? How do people get and stay healthy over time? They want to talk to you about that because they think maybe community has something to do with it. And so they summarized for us the epidemiological literature around the production of health. And they said, if you read these 8,000 volumes, what you would find is that five things determine whether people are healthy over time. That is, if you throw aside genetics and biology, that's critically important. Jan this week is talking about the DNA, and all of that is obviously critically important. But here are the five determinants of health, whether or not you and I over time are healthy people, biology aside. And it turns out not to be rocket science. our personal behavior? Have we do we exercise? Have we stopped smoking? Do we do everything we can to stay healthy on a personal level? Second, the state of our social relations. Are we embedded in family and kin networks and neighborhood? Turns out that that's critical for both mental and physical health. Third, our physical environment. Can we breathe the air? Is the water safe to drink? Are we living with rats and roaches? Fourth, our economic status. When we need to enter the market, can we do that in a powerful enough way to get what we want? And fifth, access to therapy. When we're sick, can we get to doctors and hospitals? We have any medical people in the room here? Is that okay? I want to just make sure I'm not one, and I want to make sure that these are okay with the medical people. They usually are. Sometimes faith people want to add a sixth one that has something to do with the spiritual dimension, which I think would be absolutely admissible here. So you're okay with these? All right. We asked a couple more questions. We said, since we're interested in policy all the time, from a policy perspective, if you looked at these five things and you had limited dollars, could you tell us what the most important one was? What do you think they said? People who really know this stuff, what would they say?
Personal behavior.
Okay. Any other nominations from the floor?
Social.
Access to therapy.
I'd say access to therapy, too.
Okay. All right. I love this when academics do it. It's so rare. They said, we don't know. They said, it looks like there's a lot of complicated interactions among all these things going on, but we can't pinpoint one. But they said, we can be somewhat helpful. We can tell you if you wanted to eliminate one and concentrate on the four that look like they're most important. We could tell you which one to get rid of and not pay much attention to. If the question is, where does health come from, we can tell you where not to concentrate.
Economic status.
Nope.
Access to therapy.
Access to therapy. Least important. Least important determinant of health. Whether we have access to doctors and clinics and hospitals and medical care. Turns out, this may be the only statistical thing I'll say all afternoon, that about 10% of the contribution to whether or not you and I are healthy people over time, biology and genetics aside, comes from access to therapy. The other 90% is some interactive combination of the other four, right?
That all jives with Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point.
Absolutely. So where in the United States do we spend most of our policy discussion time when we think we're talking about health?
Access to therapy.
Right. I have begun to think that what we have in the United States is a rich and vibrant discussion, but it's not about health. It's about sickness. Access to therapy is about diagnosis and treatment, which is terrifically important, and we all want that system to function well. But if we're really interested in a health discussion, we would be concentrating on how do we change personal behavior in healthy directions, strengthen social relations, clean up the physical environment, and enhance people's economic status. Think about those four things. I don't know about you, but I think for me, the last place I would go to have a really creative discussion about those four items would be a convention of the American Medical Association. Right? They don't know anything about the production of health. They know a whole lot about the diagnosis and treatment of sickness, which is critically important. And we all need to be engaged in making that quality and equitable system. But it's not about health. If I wanted to have a vibrant discussion about health, I don't know, I would go probably to a conference of the most creative community builders, and community development people, and people who cared about how to get this ramped up in local places first, and then what policy implications would follow from that. Does that make sense? So again, the point here early is, there are reasons to focus on the very local, because without activating the very local, obviously within a bigger context, you can't get to health. Real quickly, one other quick example. Some wonderfully interesting studies in the last couple of years about where do safe neighborhoods come from? Where do safe communities come from? What determines whether or not some neighborhoods are safe, some neighborhoods are not? This is a study conducted by some colleagues of ours at first the University of Chicago and Harvard, and they did some really interesting work on a bunch of different urban neighborhoods in Chicago and other cities. Some were safer, and some were less safe. And they were holding all the other kinds of variables equal, given density and income and all the rest of it. They found that two things produce safe neighborhoods. And again, this will not strike you as rocket science. Number one, you will have a safer neighborhood if residents know each other, right? And it particularly is critical that they know each other across generations, so that adults know kids, kids know adults. Secondly, you will have a safe neighborhood if residents act together in public. If they say, it's okay to come down off the porch and talk to those young men on the corner. It's okay to get together and clean up this rubble-strewn lot and make it a community garden, where there's a kind of habit of acting together in public. These are two very simple ideas, very simply expressed, but you can't get an academic article published out of Harvard in simple language. So their summary of this is that what this amounts to is an increase in collective efficacy. So the academic article tells us that safety in neighborhoods rises with the rise of collective efficacy. But you can see what it is. It's about local. And you'll notice, again, that just as doctors were not the people who were first turned to produce health, police are not the people who were turned to here to produce safe neighborhoods, right? So it's all back on the community. So back a little bit to some of our work. We have been asking over the years, what is it that gets in the way of neighborhoods, communities, towns, villages, even congregations, producing even more good outcomes? What's the problem here? What are the blockages? And obviously the blockages are many, and they have to do with economy, and they have to do with race, and they have to do with mobility and shifting demographics and all kinds of factors. But we've been concentrating, because people have taught us to do this, on one particular factor, and I want to tell you real briefly where it came from. It got clarified most strongly for me on a hot, like this, a hot July morning, many years ago, when I was in the South Bronx. And the South Bronx was one of the places that we visited constantly, looking for these stories of hope that people were creating. And our major guide in the South Bronx to these hopeful stories was a wonderful woman who I try to keep alive in my memory and others, who I met numbers of times in New York City, named Mrs. Edna Johnson. And Mrs. Johnson died about 7 years ago at the age of 84. She was an African-American woman who had lived her last 50 years in the South Bronx in New York City. And some of you who are paying attention and maybe be old enough to remember when, in the United States anyway, the South Bronx in the 70s and 80s was the place where it was broken worse, where if it was broken any place, it was worse in the South Bronx. It was just a devastated place. Paul Newman once made a movie called Fort Apache, the Bronx, in which he sort of painted this urban neighborhood as if it were the Wild West war days. Incredible devastation in the South Bronx. Over 120,000 jobs left over a two-decade period, the kinds of jobs that people used to be able to get and make a living and a hopeful future for their families without even a high school degree, where just a willingness to work hard was enough to build a hopeful future. 120,000 jobs gone. All kinds of evidence of racism existed in the South Bronx. When the population turned black and brown, all kinds of institutions had, withdrew. Those that remained were broken. It looked like the schools were making kids dumber, not smarter. It looked like the criminal justice system was producing lots more criminals than justice. Everything was busted. The South Bronx was the place in the United States where a wonderful practice was invented called arson for profit. Do you know about arson for profit? Where a slum landlord, this spread to our neighborhood in Chicago subsequently, where a slum landlord would have a big apartment building, fill it up with low-income people, jam them in there, collect rents for a few years, not put anything back into the building, and it would deteriorate, become completely unlivable, the people would start moving out. And just as the last one moved out, hopefully before they actually, after they actually got out, As his last act, the landlord would hire a torch and burn the building for the insurance money, right? So the South Bronx had lost over 60,000 units of housing to arson for profit. There were fires all the time in that community. So it was a tough place. But my friend Mrs. Johnson was there for decades before I met her. And as we continued to talk with her, doing the other kind of work, doing the sort of building up from the grassroots. One, on this July morning, I'm thinking about, she took me to see the first transplant of a wonderful program that's now a national program called Youth Build. And Youth Build was born in Harlem in the 70s, and she took it up to the South Bronx. And Youth Build basically took gang kids and taught them a few skills and turned them into carpentry co-ops. So they were rebuilding low-income housing. And we spent a morning with 15 of these kids, and they told their stories, and they were just incredibly moving stories about how proud and excited these kids were to be doing something that was productive in the community rather than engaging in the drugs and violence that they had only a year before. At any rate, we go back to Mrs. Johnson's porch. We're sitting there having some iced tea and talking about what we had just seen. And I asked her a question, which I'd never asked her before. I said, you know, these are wonderful stories, and they really do give me hope. And I can see what you can see in terms of where the South Bronx might go. But I said, it's still the South Bronx, right? It's still a really tough place. What do you think happened here? I asked her. What do you think caused the devastation in the South Bronx? And she was real quiet for a while. And I could see what she was doing. She was sort of scrolling through all the right answers about economy and about race and about broken institutions and abandonment of various kinds. But she didn't say any of that. What she finally said to me was, Jody, I think the worst thing that ever happened to us in my neighborhood is that we got put into a prison. And I was completely baffled. I said, I don't get it. We're looking at your block here, and there's some empty lots, and a couple of still abandoned buildings, and then some being rehabilitated. But I don't see the high walls and the barbed wire and the guards with machine guns. What do you mean you've been put into a prison? And she said, well, I don't mean that kind of literal prison. And then she uttered a phrase which we've been sort of thinking about ever since. She said, the prison I'm talking about is a prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are. Right? A prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are. And I said, that sounds important, but I don't think I get it. Would you tell me a little bit more about what you mean? And she said, well, let me just tell you about what happens to me every week. She said, almost every week, because I'm engaged in so many projects here, I got to go down to City Hall in Lower Manhattan or out to raise some money or talk to some congregations or some funders about this stuff. I have to go out of the neighborhood and talk to people who might support this work. And she said, almost every time, what happens to me is I walk into a room and I introduce myself and I say, hi, I'm Mrs. Edna Johnson, and I want to talk to you about my neighborhood. And people are always friendly, and they say, hi, Mrs. Johnson. Love to talk to you about your neighborhood. What neighborhood is that? And she said, I try to say it with a lilt in my voice. I try to say, I'm from the South Bronx. And she said, the lilt never works. She said, the minute I say the word South Bronx, I can see what happens to people's head. People's heads fill up with all kinds of ideas and images about what I'm talking about. They think they know my neighborhood, even though they've never been there. She said, what's so powerful about what comes into their heads is that all their images are the same. They're all of peace. They're all about our needs and our problems and our deficits and our challenges. You can imagine what some of the images might be. You want to shout out a couple?
Poor Joe.
Yep.
High crime.
Yep.
Gangs. Old cars.
Yep.
Burned out buildings.
Yep. Yep. That's yep. Cool. So what you're doing here is you're drawing with Mrs. Johnson what we started to call a neighborhood needs map. This is not a map of a particular piece of turf, or it's a map of the mind. It's what Mrs. Johnson said automatically slipped into people's heads as their definition of what they were what they were thinking about when she said South Bronx. We know about that place. That's crime and child abuse and welfare and lead dropouts and truancies and 30 others that we could think about. And this was the map that Mrs. Johnson was suggesting constituted for her and her neighbors a prison. Does that make sense for you? Right. Let me make two quick comments about this map, because we're now absolutely certain that she was right. The first is, we've been interested in trying to figure out with people in communities, where does this come from? Who draws this needs map? Where does this set of ideas about public housing or Indian reservations or small towns in trouble or big city neighborhoods like the South Bronx, where does this come from?
Media.
Media, absolutely. If we're in a church basement on the west side of Chicago, that also would be the first answer. It's the media. And of course, they don't mean community newspapers, right? They mean the downtown media, the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news. At my place at Northwestern, there's a journalism school, Medill, and the cynical slogan there is for young people beginning to cover inner city neighborhoods. They're told what you have to remember is, if it bleeds, it leads, right? We're interested in stories that are about blood. We're interested in gang fights and drug wars and drive-by shootings. And that's the news out of inner city neighborhoods. So the media draw this picture. Who else? Who else?
Politicians.
Okay, how's that work?
Basically, to say we don't want you to be like that, you know, we want you to be something else. If, you know, okay. If you're talking in the rich neighborhoods, they're saying, well, you know, you got to keep this from happening, you got to support me, and I won't let it happen.
Okay, all right, okay. How about government programs? If you're applying for a grant from a government program, or for that matter from the United Way, or a big philanthropic organization, a foundation, anybody here ever written a grant? What's the first page?
You gotta tell them what the problem is.
Absolutely. And the more convincingly you draw this map, right, about the difficulties and the problems and the challenges, the more likely you are to get the money. So this map comes from some of the most powerful institutions in our culture. I'd also add, by way of confession here, I think universities produce this map. Almost everybody who writes about, particularly struggling communities, writes about these things. They write about urban problems, urban issues, right?
Well, it's drawn from a certain kind of data. But
that's right.
The data we choose to focus on.
That's exactly. Let's count up the crime rate. Let's count up the dropout rate. Let's figure out who can't read, right? We are now pretty convinced that if this is the only map, now let's be clear about this. The problem with this map is not that it's a false map, it's a true map. The problem with it is it's not the whole truth, right? There's another set of ideas, data, that we could get from communities. But if this is our only map to reality, I'm not gonna spend much time on this, but we're pretty clear now that at least these kinds of consequences are lived out at the local level. And these are the kinds of consequences that Mrs. Johnson was saying are sort of the constituent elements of a prison, right? If I've been told often enough that I'm a deficient person, my neighbors are deficient, sometimes I internalize that. That must be right. I don't know enough to raise my kids. I don't have the skills to get the job market. I'm pretty deficient. If we've got nothing here in terms of local resources, why relate to each other locally? I'm not going to turn to my local pastor or my neighbors to solve problems, because there's nothing here. All the answers are out there someplace. All the resources are out there. If that's the map we go for, the third one, that's the way money comes in. This is money for pregnant teens, and this is money for crime, and this is money for dropouts. And insofar as those problems are real, local folks recognize they're all interrelated. Funds get directed toward professional helpers, not residents. We've got new kinds of leaders in our community. It's, when I started working in communities many, many years ago, I was trained by a guy named Saul Alinsky, who said that the first thing that you do when you go into a neighborhood is you find natural leaders, right? Well, what's a natural leader? People would ask Saul, what's a leader? And Saul would say, a leader is somebody with followers who can get something done, right? Now we have leaders in communities who are leaders by virtue of the fact that they're terrific at getting outside dollars, funding for stuff. How do they do that? They get up and tell the outside funder how bad things are here. So a leader is somebody who can denigrate their neighbors effectively and convincingly. This kind of way of operating rewards failure, produces dependency, and obviously leads to hopelessness. Let me just pause for a second. to introduce the one other thing that we never go anywhere without, which is this. This is, can you see it in the back? It's a little dark in here, but
beer.
It's not quite, I wish it were something, but it's not anything that's drinkable. But what it is the proverbial cliche,
half full, half empty
glass. You've got it.
Okay.
What I want to briefly remind you of, you know this already. It's a quick reminder that this glass, half full and half empty, is true, profoundly true, in two different ways at least. Number one, it's true about all of us, right? That everybody I've ever met is a combination of fullness and emptiness. Everybody here, and Holden just attracts gifted people, skilled people, people with all kinds of capacities and resources and knowledge and wisdom. But because many of us are part of a confessional tradition, we also remember that that we're all pretty empty too. there's some problems in our lives, there's some challenges and some difficulties and some needs. I sometimes invite people, if you really want to see obviously needy people, forget going to public housing, come to the university and I'll introduce you to the faculty. Our faculty at Northwestern, it's probably not true at Valparaiso, but at Northwestern.
What do they mean?
Yeah, at Northwestern, when we get our faculty team together, we're at a little place called the Institute for Policy Research. People from 8 different departments, 24 faculty, we get around the table and we just shake our heads. These are so obviously needy, problematic, empty, deficient people. There are a lot of them who had multiple marriages. One guy is on his 5th one, trying to get it right. You know, there are people whose children won't speak to them. There are people who drink too much. There are people with all kinds of health problems. They just filled, lives filled with challenges of all kinds. There are people who can't balance a checkbook. Fairly frequently those come from the economics department. Right? But it's just, we're recognized as a really messed up group of people. But then we also remember that at Northwestern, probably like Valparaiso and other places, we're part of a vast conspiracy, right? We conspire with each other on a daily and weekly basis, and as far as it's possible, to ignore the fact that we're so screwed up, and to instead focus on the fact that we are, many of us, good teachers, good writers, can frame a research topic, actually like people called students. We can do what it's necessary to do to run a good university. I don't know about you, but any organization I've ever been part of that works on the same principle. Let's take really messed up people and figure out what they can do, right? That's how Holden works too, right? That's how every organization works. What Mrs. Johnson was saying to us was, look, for decades, powerful outside institutions, perhaps the most powerful in the culture, have been telling us that the most important part of our glass is the empty part. It's what we don't have. It's our deficiencies and our needs and our problems and our challenges. Nobody ever asks us about the full part of the glass. And that's what she was telling us constituted the prison for her whole community. The good news is that in Mrs. Johnson's neighborhood and now hundreds of others, people have thrown out that map about emptiness, substituting a whole variety. You know, we have thousands of examples of a version of a community assets map. What do we have? What's the full part of the glass look like if we're in a community? One of the things that really struck us and surprised us when we were collecting these stories was that when we went from community to community, collecting hope stories, talking to people who did them, asking them how they did it, it didn't matter whether we were on an Indian reservation or public housing in a big city someplace, we started hearing over and over again a similar list of the ingredients of their work. When we said, how did you do that? How did you take that park back? How did you turn those gang kids around? How did you make the schools happen? How did you redo this commercial strip? They told us the story, and they told it in a way that had local assets as the starting point. And so we're now pretty clear that in every community in the United States, and now I'm getting clearer and clearer that it's not that different internationally as well, that there are 5 categories of assets that make up every community, whether we're talking about an upper middle class suburb or an inner city neighborhood. Every community has sort of 5 categories. It's like these are the categories if we were thinking about cakes rather than communities, we know that there are all kinds of different kinds of cakes, pineapple upside down and chocolate and angel food and so forth, and there are all kinds of different communities. No community is like any other. Everyone is unique. But cakes have things in common, right? Flour and something to make them rise, something to make them sweet. This is what communities have in power. Not rocket science, but it begins to give people a handle on how to get at the full part of the glass. First, let's look at everybody who lives there and assume that there's a full part of their glass and find their talents and skills and capacities and dreams and hopes. Start with that. We've done it now with dozens of different sets of relationships in public housing, for example. And one of our findings constantly in big city public housing, high-rise public housing, is that if you want to find in the United States of America the largest concentration of skilled plumbers, go to public housing developments. Because the residents of public housing are under no illusion that anybody's ever going to fix their plumbing except themselves. So everybody knows how to fix toilets and sinks and showers and bathtubs, right? And it's one thing to think about public housing as filled with destitute people, and another thing to think about them as filled with skilled plumbers, right? And you can do something with skilled plumbers that you can't with destitute people. Secondly, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time later this week thinking more about this, every community is filled with networks of relationships. I first learned that these were important when I started to do community organizing on the west side of Chicago, and I saw that I'd never get anything done, ever, without constantly talking with the four women who walked around the neighborhood on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They were the group, the network, that was at the core of the community, because they thought they were just getting exercise. But what they were really doing, they were talking with everybody, they were keeping their eyes open, they were figuring out what was going on in the neighborhood, where the bad spots were, where the good spots were, and they were the heart and soul, eyes and ears of the community. Every community is filled with those groups. Lots of them come out of churches. Churches are wonderful at producing associational life, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the week. Third, obviously, every community has some set of institutions. The distinction between two and three here are number two associations. We talk here about groups that are mostly unpaid, all right, where the people, the members do the work. They have a small staff, little church, but most, if the parish works, it works because the lay people do an awful lot of the work. Institutions and professional entities, on the other hand, are places where paid people do the work. Public ones, schools, libraries, parks, and so on. Private ones, businesses, and nonprofits. Fourth, every community, rural or urban, has some combination of physical assets, the land and the buildings and the infrastructure and transportation. And fifth, every community has some kind of economic activity going on. Even the lowest income community has people producing things, people consuming things, barters happening. So what we now think, sustainable community building over time consists of is a three-step process that uses these five. Number one, find the assets, lift them up, celebrate them, make sure everybody knows about them. Number two, connect the assets, make sure that there's a relationship between and among all of these assets in a community. And number three, harness the connected assets to a vision for the future. I want to just end, hopefully we've got a little bit of time for some back and forth here. I want to end with a quick example, a quick couple of examples, of two ways of being a human being, if you will. The first is an actual interview format that was sent to us a little while ago, and it represents the wisdom of a state welfare department. And this is what a welfare worker is supposed to know about a person after the first interview, maybe 20 minutes, when the person on welfare is starting this difficult journey from welfare to work. We're all working on the welfare to work stuff. This is the first interview. And this is what the state instructs the welfare interviewer to know about the person that she's interviewing. Tell me about your inadequate housing, your limited job-seeking skills, your poor work history, how often you've been fired from jobs, no recent work history, the high rate of absenteeism you have, never diploma or GED, the training you don't have, goes on.
Tell me about your physical problems, your bad eyes, your bad ears, your bad teeth, other medical problems. Tell me about your financial problems, which will be training. Oh, here's a neutral question, maybe. How old are you? Are you a pregnant parent, teen, a single parent? You don't have child care. You've got skills, but unfortunately, they're not in demand. You don't have reliable transportation. No driver's license. You've got sick dependents. You don't have the necessary license or credentials. You don't communicate very well, do you? You're uncertain about your employee goals. They're unrealistic. You don't have the right clothes. You've got family problems. they won't be very supportive about your working. Tell me about your history of mental illness, the drug or alcohol abuse, your felony record, how often you lost your benefits. Now we know everything that we need to know about this particular person.
I mean, all of us at a certain age we have failed.
Absolutely. I think, I don't know, any reactions to that? Other than that?
And everything's framed in the negative, so the assumption there from the start is...
It's a very thorough map to empty us.
No assets.
None.
Well, it just drains of anyone of any enthusiasm to do anything.
Absolutely.
Totally.
Yeah, you can just see the psychological dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, as you say, people start to imagine themselves into those questions, and then if they... feel they cannot do anything else, they want at least to get the social welfare.
Yeah.
So they will kind of shape themselves into it.
That's right, exactly. All I can possibly be is a recipient. I can't act. That's right. I'm pretty convinced if the interviewee here is a 24-year-old single mother of three, I'll bet it's the dozenth time in her life since maybe first grade that somebody in authority has, in a sense, held up a mirror to her, saying, "You're a worthless human being. Right? That you are defined by your emptiness." And I think, by the way, that we do this not only to welfare recipients, because people know that we collect this stuff. They send us piles of these things from all over the place. So we've got a pile for welfare recipients, but now we've got a pile for young people too. It turns out that one of the places where this happens to young people is the first time they get in trouble. They get interviewed by somebody in the juvenile justice system, and the questions are all, how often have you contemplated suicide? Tell me about your drug use and your alcohol use. Tell me about how often you were beaten as a kid. All of the stuff that's completely on them. Tell me about your gang involvement. All of the unsavory people that you hang out with. I think it also happens a little bit to older adults as people begin to sort of think about what's next in life, and maybe some assisted living help or something like that. All of the questions are about what can't you do, right? What's broken now? What can't you remember? All of the stuff that everybody's going to go through. We also have a staff, by the way, from the immigration people who sit down new immigrants and do this with them. Tell me about all the trouble you were in the old country. All of the bad things that you did. We're now pretty convinced that this set of interactions is one major way in which people get marginalized in communities. They get defined by powerful institutions, by their emptiness, and labeled as if that is the only important thing about them, and therefore they have nothing to contribute, and they're pushed to the edge.
Well, I think about the social worker too, the interviewer, that person either bails or else gets cynical.
That's exactly right. This is one of the major causes of burnout, I think, for people in social welfare professions. Absolutely. If you had to do that all day, where would your head be by the end of the day?
Well, also, when you start with something big like that, like I know I have someone who's close to me who lost a child, right? And if that's the first thing somebody finds out about them, it's hard to get past that.
Yeah.
It's hard to get to know the whole rest of that person and their... You know, that is the thing that just stops them. So if you have something really big and it's negative, then, you know, it evokes such a response that don't see the big picture.
Absolutely.
Well, there's a whole other area, too, and that is not the social science area, but I sort of stumbled into activism by accident. And there's all kinds of institutions that are trying to keep you from empowering you and your neighbors from doing things that they think they're responsible for.
That's right.
And there's, you know, damned if they're going to let you, you know, do any of that because it diminishes their power.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit more later in the week. I think that's exactly right. Let me just end with one other quick example. This is the opposite. We've been collecting lots and lots of examples of what's not that last thing. People call them different things. We've got one book filled with them called A Guide to Capacity Inventories. That's the sort of opposite of that needs interview. And I want to show you one real quickly, one of my favorite ones. This one comes from a big Baptist church in Cincinnati, the largest African-American Baptist church in Cincinnati. It's called New Prospect Baptist, and it's pastored by a dear colleague and friend of ours, Reverend Damon Lynch. And Damon is just a genius community builder as well as a wonderful pastor. What happened here is that New Prospect ran the largest soup kitchen, still does, in Cincinnati, Ohio. They're in an inner city neighborhood right downtown called Over the Rhine, poorest neighborhood in Cincinnati. And they were feeding over 300 people a night. And what happened a few years ago was that almost all at once, a whole bunch of the lay leaders in the soup kitchen got frustrated with what they were doing. And the frustration, as they started to talk about it, had to do with, well, why are we seeing the same people back here all the time? It's important to feed people, but couldn't we be doing more? Couldn't we make a difference in their lives? And they started asking themselves, well, why aren't we? What could we do differently? Their answer was interesting. Their answer was, you can't make a difference in anybody's life if you don't have a relationship with them, if you don't know them. We don't know these people. And they sort of backed off for a minute, and then they said, you know, that's not entirely true. We know quite a bit about their emptiness. Some are homeless, some are jobless, some are fighting drug and alcohol. We don't know much about their fullness. Let's find out about that. And so they constructed a one-page survey, which from my point of view is one of those sort of eloquent and respectful ways of having a conversation that I know about. Let me just go over it with you really quickly. Still, 20-minute conversation over a cup of tea, a cup of coffee with people who were coming to the soup kitchen. Thanks for coming over. They named this whole process a gift exchange. Did somebody talk to you about what this gift exchange is all about? What do you understand it to be? So right away, they're validating the possibility that the person they're talking to has an idea about what this is. And then they state their own. Basically, we believe that everybody has God-given talents and gifts that can be used to benefit the community. I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about your gifts and skills. Then they start, they say, let me give you a small gift. The kids in the church had spent really a lot of time putting together small gift boxes, all filled with a gift. And the gift that starts the conversation is a keychain, wonderfully calligraphy, with a really quite profound piece of community building wisdom on it. So they open the gift at the beginning of the interview, and the keychain says, your gift is your key to your community. Your gift is your key to your community. And so they sort of think about that for a minute. Then they get into the questions. And their hypothesis here is that if you want to know about the full part of a human being, if you talk about the full part of a community, has five components. If you knew about that person's gifts and skills and dreams, you'd be a long way toward knowing what the fullness looks like. So that's what they ask them about, gifts and skills and dreams. Gifts or abilities we're born with. What positive qualities do people say you have? So you don't have to brag. Did somebody once said I was a good listener? Who are the people in your life that you give to? How do you give to them? When was the last time you shared with somebody else? What was it? A lot of the answers there were the wine bottle last night, and that was fine. What do you give that makes you feel good? Skills, what are you best at? What do you enjoy doing? If you could start a business, what would it be? I love the third question. This is the vocational question that we all should ask ourselves once every 6 months or something. What do you like to do that people would pay you to do, right? Ever made anything, ever fixed anything, and then your dreams, what are they? If you could snap your fingers and be doing anything, what would it be? And these were not people who'd been asked about their dreams very frequently that they were asking in the soup kitchen. I want to thank you. We're talking to as many people as we can. We want to do two things here. We're going to build a wall of fame in the soup kitchen, and we want to the ultimate goal is to find a way to use these gifts in rebuilding the community. So let me just real briefly describe what I saw when I visited this place. About 6 months after they had started these conversations, they had done about maybe 230, 240 of these conversations. And I had visited the soup kitchen with Pastor Lynch a number of times before.
So I knew it, and I knew some of the people in it. And I walked in this time, and it looked really different than the other times. I walked in, it's a room maybe 8 times, 10 times as big as this, big old warehouse room. And the walls used to be white cinder block, but they're not white any longer. They're splashed with primary colors and geometric shapes, triangles and rectangles and circles. And inside each geometric shape is a person, a report on the full part of that person. So often a blown up Polaroid or a big caricature that one of the talented artists did. And the person's name, and then simply a listing of a lot of that person's gifts and skills and dreams. And what they had found was really quite extraordinary in these first 230 or 40 interviews. They had found, for example, over 40 people with carpentry skills. And so they put a brown saw next to each one of those people and linked it with big brown lines to other people on the wall. And what I learned was that they had been convening these 40 people with carpentry skills over the months, and that just the month before, about 15 of them had decided to form a carpentry cooperative and had begun the work of setting up the co-op and rehabilitating some of the rundown buildings in the Over the Rhine neighborhood. In the first couple of hundred interviews, they had found over 70 people with musical skills, played an instrument of some kind, or sang. And that explained why in one corner of the soup kitchen, there was a 5-piece jazz combo playing during the supper hour, made up of people who had discovered each other through this process. I always say it wasn't the best jazz combo I've ever heard, but it was spirited, and they were just getting to know each other. In another corner, there were a group of people who had been discovered through this process who had had some kind of child care experience, and they vetted those people very carefully. And there was a kids' corner going on with all kinds of stories being read, music being played, games being played, a really joyful part of the soup kitchen. And so there's all this stuff happening. And I was struck by the sort of cumulative power of it. And I looked around the place and spent a few minutes just sort of looking around it. And the more I looked around, the more sort of puzzled I was at what I was seeing. And so I had to ask some more questions to figure it out. And here's what I discovered. I discovered that when they asked about skills, what do you do best? What do you like to do best? One skill got mentioned far more frequently than any other skill. Just over the top, the most frequently mentioned skill was one. Any guesses?
Able to be friendly.
Could have been that.
Talk to people,
could have been that. But instead, it was something a little bit more specific. It was cooking. Over 50% of the people said, I love to cook. Cook a mean pot of beans. And after a while, this is a soup kitchen, right? The church folks began thinking about the answer that they were hearing so frequently. And they began understanding pretty quickly that they were not hearing just about a skill called cooking. That what people were really saying to them is, look, I don't want to be on this side of the table anymore. With you on the other side of the table, cooking for me and serving me. Because as long as I'm over here and you're over there, you are a fully valued member of this community, and I'm nothing. I want to come around on the cooking side, and I want to be a valued member of this community too. So when they heard that and started thinking about it, the church people, who were a courageous and wise group, decided to act on it. And they decided to act in two ways. The first thing they did was they changed the rules for the volunteers. They said, we still need dozens of people. This is a big operation. It's a difficult one to keep going. We need you. But here's a new rule. If you're a volunteer here, come hungry. Nobody just cooks or serves or delivers the food. Everybody eats. This is an eating community. And they got a little bit of resistance from some of the folks. Are you going to eat with those people? But almost everybody who was a volunteer adjusted and became part of the eating community. Then they decided, well, what are we going to do with the people coming in for a meal? We can't just change the rules for them. That's not going to work. And so they decided to do something much more interesting in a community building way. They went back over their interview notes and found the 20 most enthusiastic would-be cooks. The people who just sort of jumped out of their chair and said, I love to cook. I really do cook a wonderful pot of chili. And they went back to those folks one-to-one and said, we really need you in the kitchen. We noticed that you were really enthusiastic about cooking, and this place could use your skills in the kitchen. What they reported to me was that 19 out of the 20 jumped on the chance and began appearing the next night in the kitchen. And many of them then began appearing multiple times a week as part of the cooking team. Then what happened, faster than any of the church people had expected, was that people who were coming in for a meal began seeing their friends and colleagues in the kitchen back there and asking, what are they doing back there? They're obviously helping. Do you need me to do anything? Do you need me in the kitchen? Or if you don't need me in the kitchen, can I help serve? Or if you've got enough people to serve, this place needs some cleanup afterwards. Can I wash dishes? Can I take care of some of the updating on the walls? We want these walls to be living walls. How about a child care corner? And so they began working out ways that they were going to be part of the soup kitchen. What I saw as a result of all this, to get back to the beginning of that story, what baffled me was, it was the first soup kitchen I had ever been in my life, where when I looked out over this huge floor with 250 or 300 people milling around doing stuff, eating them, and I thought about it, I said, you know, I can't tell who's who here. I don't know who are the people from the church who are volunteering and who are the people who came in for a meal, right? You understand? Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, this is a little glimpse of what I think a healthy community is. It's kind of a microcosm here. A healthy community is one in which everybody gets recognized as gifted, and nobody can hide from giving their gifts, right? Where everybody is giving and everybody's getting, right? In a sense, what the church folks had done was to recognize the ironic but almost inevitable power differential between people who serve and help and people who are served and are helped. It's a little bit ironic, but the people who serve always have power over the people who are being served, right? The client, the professionals always have power over the clients. And they had tried to figure out a way, they wouldn't talk about it this way the first time, but about how to equalize that power relationship. So it was an exchange. It was a two-way street. It was reciprocal. Everybody giving and everybody getting.
Partnering.
Partnering, absolutely. Which leads me to my last comments. One of the most interesting conversations I got into then with the church folks was, they were saying, you know, we've got all this language about service and help, and that's not useful because it makes this happen. So what's the language about this? And they were rediscovering the power of old language. And one of the words they came back to, let's partner with people. Another couple of words they came back to, what's this like? Not this, what's this? Friends, let's be friends, right? Let's get to know each other. And, or they came back to neighbors. Let's figure out what neighbors do for each other, right? And so they were turning the soup kitchen into a neighboring friendship building kind of place. For me, that's a little bit of a vision of what a healthy, vital community is. And it's also finally a vision for me of what the core of a democratic community is. I think a democracy that's vibrant doesn't start in Washington, D.C., or in Olympia, or even in City Hall. That it really rests on locality, on people in parishes and neighborhoods, figuring out how to act on their giftedness with their neighbors. And that, in a sense, is the core definition for me of what a citizen is. I don't mean a citizen in terms of somebody's legal status, but a citizen defined as somebody who comes out of the house every morning, recognizing her own giftedness, determined to link with her neighbor's giftedness to make our public life stronger, more vital, and better. So the soup kitchen for me became a little incomplete, obviously, vision of what the kingdom of God might look at in an earthly kind of manifestation. We've gone over. I'm sorry about that. But I'd love to continue this conversation through the week.